Chapter 40 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Lagimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 40. To go back to the period I had reached at the beginning of the last chapter, a few months after the ransom action. My reconciliation with Olive was not really permanent or complete. After the first emotion of making friends with her again, I did not see much of her. I got rid of my Hampstead house and went to live with my mother in the early part of 1914, at a small house she had taken for a few months in Chelsea. Previously to this, and right up to the time when, as I shall presently describe, I left England to avoid being called up for judgment for having, as was alleged, broken my recognizances by repeating my libel on Colonel Custance, I had been, with Crossland's assistance, doing all I could to bring Ross to book. Accidentally, and through a paragraph I saw in a Sunday paper, I got to hear of a 16-year-old boy named Garrett, who was then in prison, and who had at his trial called in his defence to speak for him a certain great friend and associate of Ross. I got permission from the Home Office to send a solicitor to see this boy in prison. The solicitor saw the boy, in the presence of a warder, and the boy made a statement more or less incriminating Ross, whom he declared he knew well. The boy declined to go into details, but said that if the solicitor would meet him, or send someone to meet him, at the prison gates on his release, he would tell him everything. This was done. The boy was met, and he made a statement incriminating Ross. I took the boy to Scotland Yard, and he repeated the statement, I not being present, to the police inspector, who took down what he said. The boy signed the statement. The police, however, after several days had elapsed, declined to take any action. I sent Crossland down to see the boy's mother in the country. In the end she came up and swore an information, and went, accompanied by my solicitor, and with the boy, to apply before a magistrate for a warrant against Ross. The magistrate's clerk, however, told her to come again later in the day. She went away, and meanwhile the boy ran away and disappeared. I may say that this charge against Ross formed part of my plea of justification when I justified my charges against him later on in the same year. Contemporaneously with this, and in pursuance of my determination to force Ross into the courts to prosecute me and give me the opportunity of proving my charges against him, I wrote to various friends of his, including the then Prime Minister, Mr. Asquith, Lord Oxford, making charges against him. At the same time I wrote to Custance a letter in which I remonstrated with him on the attitude he had taken up towards my marriage, and the separation between my wife and myself, which I attributed to him. Custance took my letter to George Lewis, who immediately declared that by writing this letter I had broken my recognizances, and that an application should be made to the recorder who had tried the case and bound me over, to call me up, to show cause why I should not be committed to prison. A summons was served on me. I saw in a flash the trap I was in. If the recorder sent me to prison for 6 months, as I took it for granted, quite mistakenly, that he was certain to do, I was done for ever. For as soon as I was in prison, Lewis would apply for a warrant against me for criminal libel on Ross, and, being in prison, it would be impossible for me to get the evidence required to defend myself and justify my charges. I accordingly took what looks on the face of it like the fatal step of clearing out of the country and going to Boulogne. Yet if I had not done this, so wonderful are the ways of Providence, I would never have settled Ross. If I had gone up before the recorder, it is extremely unlikely that he would have held that my letter to Custance constituted a breach of my recognizances. In fact, it did nothing of the kind, for it did not repeat the libel, or so much as refer to it, and had reference to something quite different. In any case, even if the recorder had held that what I had done amounted to a breach of my recognizances, he certainly would not have sent me to prison, for I did not do so a few months later, when I had repeated the libel on Custance, and added others. Supposing that I had gone up before the recorder, nothing would have happened to me beyond, at the worst, a lecture and a warning to be careful. But, and this is the wonderful part of the story, if I had not run away and gone to Boulogne, Ross would never have prosecuted me at the Old Bailey 8 months later. As long as I was in the country, he would never have dared to go for me. It was precisely because he thought that I had gone away and would never come back, or at any rate not for years, that he went with Lewis to a magistrate and applied for, and obtained, 2 warrants for my arrest, as I shall presently describe. I fled from London on the 4th of March, the anniversary of my wedding day, and went to Boulogne, where I found Dick Luckman and his second wife and child staying at a hotel. I went to their hotel and remained in Boulogne till about 2 months after the war broke out. While I was in Boulogne, Crossland came over to see me several times and stayed as my guest at my hotel. One day dear little D-blank-E-blank came with him and spent 2 hours with me, and that was the last time I saw her, for immediately afterwards she went back to her native country, the United States. She came from San Francisco. She wrote to me from there about a year later, and begged me to come over to America. She told me she had now got plenty of money. Fond as I was of her, I was determined, for religious reasons, that nothing would induce me to see her any more. I thought it best not to answer her letter. Crossland and I carried on the campaign against Ross and Custance from Boulogne. I had several hundred copies printed of 2 letters to my father-in-law, which I circulated in England. They both contained references to Ross, and were used as part of Ross's indictment of me later at the Old Bailey. Then one day Crossland went back to London, after spending a couple of days with me, and was arrested, and charged with conspiring with Lord Alfred Douglas to bring a false charge against Robert Ross in respect of the boy Garrett. The history of Crossland's trial, which lasted for 8 days at the Old Bailey, belongs more properly to his biography than to mine. My old and valued friend, Mr. Sawley Brown, who for years has fought my battles in his splendid paper, The Border Standard, has just published A Life of Crossland, and I refer those who wish to read about this sensational case to that volume. Crossland was defended by Cecil Hayes, and the leading counsel against him was F. E. Smith, now Lord Birkenhead. The trial ended in the complete discomfiture of Ross and the triumphant acquittal of Crossland. As it was a case of conspiracy, I was also included in the charge, and if I had been in England, I too would have been arrested and charged with Crossland. As soon as I heard that Crossland had been arrested and released on bail, his surety being my cousin, Sholto Johnston Douglas, the portrait painter, son of Arthur Johnston Douglas of Cumlongan Castle, Dumfriesshire, owner of Old Joe, who won the Grand National in 1886, as I have already described in the first chapter of this book, I determined to return to England and stand my trial with Crossland. However, Crossland telegraphed me not to come till he had seen me. He was out on bail, and asked the police if they had any objection to his going over to Boulogne to see me. The police raised no objection at all, which seems rather queer, but I think the explanation was that Ross and Sir George Lewis would have been only too pleased if Crossland had skipped his bail and allowed the case to go against him by default. Crossland came over to me and strongly urged me not to come back to England till his trial was over. We both felt perfectly confident that he must be acquitted, and that such acquittal would be a severe knockout for Ross and the enemy generally. The situation was that, if I came back, I would immediately be arrested on Ross's conspiracy warrant, and would then, of course, be released on bail. But then, again, I would be rearrested on the recorder's bench warrant, which had been issued directly I left England. Then, supposing the recorder sent me to prison, as I thought, quite mistakenly, that he was certain to do, I should be in a very awkward position with the other trial to face. Consequently, we agreed that it would be better policy to stay where I was and await the issue of Crossland's trial. We carried out this plan. Crossland came over to Boulogne and spent every weekend with me, and when his acquittal took place, it of course carried mine with it. So there was the end of that. At this time, before Crossland's acquittal, I actually had no less than 3 warrants out for my arrest in London. I knew of only 2, the recorder's bench warrant and Ross's warrant for conspiring with Crossland to bring a false charge against him. Really, of course, the charge was perfectly true, as was subsequently established. But, in addition to these 2 warrants, Ross had also taken out a warrant against me for criminal libel. I knew nothing of this till I came back to England 2 or 3 months later. Crossland was in great form in the witness box in his case. I remember particularly one witty remark he made. In reply to a question from Mr. F. E. Smith, he said something about the jury, whereupon Mr. Smith said, "Oh, never mind the jury can take care of themselves." Crossland replied, "Yes, but I want them to take care of me," which was received with great laughter. It is the healthiest thing in the world if you can get the judge and jury laughing at your replies in the witness box, and nothing is so disconcerting to counsel opposed to you. Of course, I don't mean that one should try to be funny. Nothing could be more fatal. But if an answer comes out quickly and naturally, and happens to raise genuine laughter, it is a very good sign, especially in a criminal case. Juries don't laugh at a man's remarks if they're going to convict him. Crossland proved himself to be more than a match for the deadly cross-examination of F.E. Smith, and indeed he succeeded in making Smith look rather foolish several times. Smith endeavoured to get his own back by a very virulent closing speech to the jury, in which he attacked me in the most savage manner. I was not there to answer back, but I promptly replied by writing and getting 1,000 copies printed and circulated of a lampoon called The Rhyme of F.A.A., which may be read in my collected satires. During the time when Crossland was out on bail, and from the moment when he was arrested, my dear mother, at my request, supplied him with ample funds. Cecil Hayes defended him for nothing, or I suppose I ought to say for a nominal fee, for I believe he had 5 guineas marked on his brief, in contrast to F.E. Smith's 500 guineas and refreshers, which ran the whole amount up into thousands. Crossland also came over every weekend and stayed at my expense at Boulogne. I am obliged to mention all this because I afterwards discovered that Crossland, imitating the tactics of Oscar Wilde, went about telling everyone he met that neither I nor my family had given him 6 pence at this time. My mother, as a matter of fact, gave him about £250, although at the time, with the war just starting, she was, like most other people, much embarrassed financially. Just about this time, my book, Oscar Wilde and Myself, which I had written with Crossland, giving him half the proceeds, came out. In the book, there is next to nothing about Ross. The publishers prevented me from telling anything like the real truth about the part he had played, and in many other respects they interfered with the author in a way which was bound to injure the book. To put the lid on all this, the book actually appeared on the very day war was declared. End of chapter 40.